by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are grass make the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler along with my co-host.
Charlotte Littlefield. Good evening, George.
Okay, Charlotte. How's it going up there in Missouri? Okay.
Wonderful. We're having some nice fall weather. Yeah, it's very nice. Thanks for asking.
Okay. We've got just a wonderful guest this evening. I've actually interviewed him several years ago on his first book, but it's been maybe 4 or 5 years. I've forgotten exactly. But his name is St. John Hunt. His latest book is entitled Dorothy. Welcome to our program, St. John Hunt.
Thank you, George, and thank you, Charlotte. It's a pleasure to be here on the show with you, and I'd like to thank all the listeners that you have for supporting your show, The Secret Truth. It's a great show.
Right. Charlotte, did you have something to say?
No, I just wanted to thank him for the compliment, and I wanted to say a little bit more about the title of your book, Dorothy, An Amoral and Dangerous Woman. I love the word an amoral and dangerous woman, what it meant during the time that she served, and then the murder of E. Howard Hunt's wife, Watergate's Darkest Secret, by yourself, St. John Hunt, and the forewords by Roger Stone. Yeah, and it's a fabulous read, quite the human interest story. You've had quite the life, quite the adventure, I'm afraid.
Yeah, it has its good side, and it has its downside too, but that's the way all life is, I think, in whatever one is doing. And of course, this is a life that I didn't choose for myself, at least back in those days. But to bring the story out, I did choose to do that, and I'm really happy I did, because I think it's fitting that my mother, that her story is known, and that people understand a little bit more about that dark chapter of Watergate where that plane crashed that took her life and
yes,
some of the others as well.
That's very important. Give our listening audience a little bit of, excuse me, Charlotte, what'd you say?
Oh, I was going to say, so you are the son of Dorothy. I mean, you're one of her children.
Yes,
and so you're telling your mother's story. I mean.
That's right.
And it's very moving. And
yeah, and this was a difficult book to write, was it not, St. John?
Yeah, it was, for many more reasons than my first book, Bond of Secrecy. That wasn't as difficult or as emotionally taxing as this book, because I kept, reliving, you know, the moments I had with my mother, so many of them. And then as it drew closer and closer to her death, it just felt like, you know, I was experiencing her loss all over again. And you know, the part where I write that she, you know, that she's finally killed.
Right.
It just felt like someone had punched me in the stomach, and all the wind was taken out of me. It was really difficult to get through that part. But I'm better off for it.
Yeah, you're stronger about it. And the time I met you last year, you seemed to have bounced back, and you're in better shape than you've ever been. Tell our listening audience a little bit about who you are, who your father was, your mother's relationship with your dad, and some of her past jobs there in Switzerland and stuff. Just give us an overall, just a summary of her life here at the beginning. Could you do that?
Sure. Yes, of course. Well, basically, as condensed as I can do it, my father was E. Howard Hunt, and my mother was Dorothy Wetzel. They both worked in the intelligence field, primarily in the early days. My father worked for OSS, the precursor for CIA, and my mother worked in the Treasury Department, which had an OSS affiliation at that time in Bern, Switzerland. She worked in Operation Safe Haven, tracking Nazi gold and art across Europe. And the main point of that was to block and stop the flow of the Nazi assets that were being moved in and around Europe, to locate them and to get control of them for the OSS. My father worked at the same time in a separate department in the OSS. He was off in China and elsewhere. But in 1949, they met and married. My mother, in 1946, she was on the last train out of China, Shanghai, China, as it fell to the communists. And that's quite a gripping story also. But they married in 49, and she became primarily a housewife and mother to her growing family, but she also remained an asset for the CIA by working in the embassies of the various host countries that we moved to. And we moved around a lot, Japan, Montreal, Uruguay, Madrid, Paris, Japan, and all these different cities. Let's see, my father rose quickly through the ranks of CIA. He headed up the Guatemala coup in 1954 that deposed Jacob Arbenz and installed the pro-American puppet dictator Castillo Armas. In 1957, we all moved to Montevideo, Uruguay, where my father meets Vice President Richard Nixon. That established a link between Nixon and my father that went all the way through the time of Watergate as well. In 1959, my father, under Nixon's green light, established Operation 40, along with a few other CIA heads like Tracy Barnes and Richard Bissell. And Operation 40 was a tight-knit group of assassins that CIA wanted to put together to assassinate originally Cubans, leftist Cubans during and after a successful invasion of Cuba, which was the Bay of Pigs, which, as everybody knows, failed miserably. My father blamed President Kennedy for that failure and kept a vengeance for him the rest of his life. Later on, my father was admitted to me on his deathbed confession that he had a stake in the assassination of President Kennedy in 1963 there in Dallas. And that was a pretty interesting time for him and I in the early 2000s when he was revealing these things to me as he was slowly succumbing to cancer and various other things. But then Watergate happens in 1972, June 17, 1972. My father comes to my room in the basement, wakes me up, and orders me upstairs, which I came, you know, quickly, and I wiped down fingerprints on two large suitcases. And the next few days, I helped my father in the transfer of large amounts of cash from safety deposit boxes in and around Washington, D.C., back to our home in Potomac. My mother, from her vacation in Europe, where she was vacationing with my sisters, and in December of 72, she was on a flight to Chicago with evidence that her father had kept in order to pressure, and they called it blackmail, in order to blackmail President Nixon in continuing the hush money funds that my mother had been picking up at late night locations in and around D.C., such as the Greyhound station and the airport there. That plane crashed very close to the airport, but not at the airport. And my father pled guilty a week later for his role in Watergate and went to prison for 3.5 years.
Right. Getting back to the first, when your mom and your dad first met, your father was a writer, right, of fiction? Is that right?
Yes, he had started his writing career, and he had won a Guggenheim Fellowship for his first novel, East of Farewell. It was at that point that he made a decision whether he was going to pursue a career solely as a writer or whether he was going to continue with his career as an intelligence officer. And of course, he chose intelligence, and he supported his financial career by writing books. And in the end, he wrote 88 novels, 88 published novels in his life, and he died when he was 88. So on average, he had one book a year that was published. That's pretty good for someone that was as busy as my dad.
Yeah. Your mother, of course, they came together and started having children. Do you have, some siblings, what, two sisters and a younger brother?
Yes, I do. I have two older sisters and a younger brother, David.
Okay. Now, then you were third. Now, as this thing unfolded, your mother was drawn into this Watergate, problem and trying to wade through it. Some people would say that she was helping to pay off some of the hush money. Is that what you were saying earlier? And so she was taking a lot of chances and risk. Is that right?
Yeah, she was. They had a setup where my mother and I went with her on one or two occasions to the local phone booth in Potomac Village, which was just about 8 or 10 minutes away from our house. And this is on the outskirts of Washington, D.C., and we'd wait there for the phone to ring. She'd get up and answer to the phone and very quickly put the phone down, and then we'd drive back to our house, and then she would continue on to her designated location with instructions. So let's say this time it would be go to the Greyhound station and go to the third phone booth on the left side, and underneath will be a key taped, and that key will correspond to a locker, and in that locker will be a satchel full of cash. This was during what I call the war with Nixon. My family and President Nixon were basically at war, and of course they must have known it was a losing proposition, because you can't win a war with the President of the United States. But Nixon, as anyone can hear on the White House tapes, was in full favor of continuing to pay my father. I mean, he's heard on the White House transcripts as saying, we can pay Hunt $1 million or more, and he knew where to get the $1 million, and he wanted to get it. And his inner counsel just didn't understand why Nixon was so fearful of E. Howard Hunt. I mean, they knew my father's reputation, which is why Nixon hired him to head up the plumbers unit in the White House 2 years before that, but they didn't know exactly why Nixon was so worried about my father. And the reason he was is because the evidence my father had not only could shed light on Nixon's approval of Watergate, but many of the other Watergate-related crimes that they had done, such as the breaking and entering of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office in Los Angeles. They broke into the Chilean embassy. They there was a plan afoot to firebomb the Brookings Institute, and there was a whole slew of Watergate-related crimes. There was a houseboat and down in Miami where the Democratic National Convention was going on, and that was going to be loaded with hookers and two-way mirrors and cameras and drugs, and these hookers were going to lure Democrats to the houseboat and give them drugs and then film them for blackmail. There was a lot of wiretapping things going on, and so the breaking at Watergate was just one tiny part of it, and my father had evidence of all these other crimes that they had done for Nixon. But on a larger scale, he had evidence that Nixon green-lighted and approved of the assassination attempts against Fidel Castro starting in the early 60s. And Nixon felt that if that came out, that he had approved of assassinating a foreign leader, that would not only end his political career, but may very well put him in jail. Definitely impeached and in jail. And so he was very enthusiastic and far off to the tune of $1 million.
Right. St. John, this has had quite an emotional effect on your whole family, has it not?
Yes, it has.
And
I would imagine so. I mean, I know my brother and I, but my sisters, they don't talk to me, so I'm sure it has had an emotional effect on them, but I just don't know.
Was your mother, towards the end of this, you know, Watergate, you know, problem and all that, was she looking out for her interest of her children? She seemed to imply that she'd gone to Europe and come back, and maybe she was contemplating a divorce or something. Would it be that protection of her children is one of her main motivations, or what?
I think so. Certainly that was very key. But she had also wanted to leave my father for several years already, but felt that the time wasn't right, I guess. And then they started arguing quite a bit when my father retired from the CIA in 1970 and then quickly joined the White House and formed this internal investigation unit, which was known as the Plumbers. I could hear them arguing. My mother didn't want my father to do that. She felt that these men, President Nixon and Charles Colson, who brought my dad into the White House, were taking advantage of my father's patriotism and his connections in the CIA. And of course, now we know that in fact, that's exactly what they were doing. And they were totally prepared to leave my father hanging high and dry, which they did. And even worse, you know, with the plane crash that killed my mother. So she was looking to get away from all of that. But as loyal of a person as she was, she stuck it out and it killed her.
Yes. Her background from what? From the Midwest? She was from the Midwest. Is that right, where she was born?
Dayton, Ohio, yes, 1920.
Yeah. And that's about as middle America as you can get, right? And then she started a series of government jobs, which brought her in contact. I think she was working with Alan Dulles, what, in Switzerland for OSS? Is that right?
Yes. Okay. Yes, she was. Alan Dulles was the OSS head of operations in Bern, Switzerland, and he was in charge of that Operation Safe Haven, among many other operations. And that was very, very early on, where intelligence was first interweaving with other government departments, such as State Department and Treasury Department. Initially, it was State and Treasury that were running Operation Safe Haven, but OSS was then given control of Safe Haven as the overseer of the entire project. And within OSS, Safe Haven came under the control of the SI branch, as well as the X2 division. SI branch being secret intelligence, and the X2 division is the counterintelligence program. So she, at that point, blended into the OSS, SI, and X2 divisions of secret and counterintelligence work for OSS. And she continued doing that when she went to Shanghai, China, and on until the till 1950.
Right. Your mom loved horses. This place that y'all ended up growing up and so forth, it was several acres, and y'all had some horses out there. And your mom just loved horses. Is that right?
Yeah, she was an avid equestrian, and she rode as often as she could. She had an Arabian horse. We had a small we had 14 acres, and we had a front paddock and a back paddock, horse stables, and the whole nine yards. And when we lived in Montevideo, Uruguay, the children, all of us, went to equestrian school for 4 years. So we were, professionally trained in the English style of riding. And she was happiest when she was out in the fields riding on her horse, just the wind in her hair and. She just couldn't have been happier than at those moments, and I remember that so well. The summer before she died, we spent a good deal of time together, listening to music, riding horses, taking care of the horses, and talking about her life, which is where I learned so much of what I wrote down in this book. I had never known all the things that she was involved in.
So you in your later teens, y'all got closer and closer. Is that right?
And then it ended after that.
Yeah, y'all got much closer as you reached your late teens.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yes, very much so.
And now this music thing. Did she love music as much as you
yes,
did?
Yes, it is. Uh-huh.
Did y'all sort of share that as a love for music and appreciation or what?
Yes, we did. She had a little record player in her bedroom, and we'd play each other our favorite songs, parts of albums that we had. I'd play her some Beatles, and she'd play me some Frank Sinatra, and that was a wonderful exchange. Of course, my father was very much into music, and he was a fantastic trumpet player and a pianist.
Okay.
And he supported my love for music as well.
So he was a musician too. Is that where you got some of your musical ability, you think, from your dad and your mom, or what?
Yes, and I would say primarily from my father. He was very gifted. He had a perfect natural ear. In other words, if you told him to hum a C note or a D note, he would pause for a moment and think, and then he would hum, and it would be right on.
Right.
So he had a perfect sense of timing too.
Right. There was a time, and I want you to sort of tell the story, of course, in your own words, that you and your older sister were at the house, and these men come in and say, "We're going to sell the house, and y'all have to move." Boy, that was upsetting, was it not?
That was probably one of the worst.
Give us a chronology of where you were at that point. What had happened before? Had you lost your mom before that point? Is that right? And so forth.
Yes. Uh huh. Yes. We had lost our mother. Our father was in prison, and it was my older sister Lisa, the eldest, and myself, and our little brother David, who was nine. And we were continuing to live in our home. You know, we had nowhere else to live in Potomac. It was called Witch's Island, by the way, and it was a name my mother gave it because it looked spooky at night. And we had a long gravel driveway that went in a circular fashion, looped around and came back down again, and it created an island in the middle of it.
Okay.
And so she named it Witch's Island. But she had died in December, and in January and February, we started getting, we got a notice, a letter from attorneys saying that it's possible that the house might be sold to pay for attorney fees for my father. So we went about the business of starting to pack things up to facilitate the sale of the house. But one day, my godfather, William F. Buckley Jr., who was a very conservative he's the founder of National Review and a TV talk show host and a good friend of my father's. Matter of fact, he had been recruited by my father for the CIA back in the 50s. And he shows up with a couple of guys and tells us we have, less than 30 days to get out. And they're going to lock down the house. And they went about grabbing my little brother and just pulling him out of our arms. He was crying. He didn't know what was going on, and my sister was crying and screaming, and I was trying to fight them off and pull my brother back to our arms. And they grabbed him and thrust him in a car and drove away. And Lisa and I were left standing there, just in utter shock and disbelief, and it was probably the worst moment of my life. Just my little brother David, I felt so bad for him because he needed us more than ever at that point, and here he was being ripped away from his family and kidnapped down to live in Miami, which was a very bad decision because it had consequences that we were not that we couldn't see at the time. He got involved in some bad stuff down there, and when he was very young and became addicted to substance abuse at the age of 12 because of who he was living with and things like that. That was a horrible time.
But you worked through it, right? And there was a period of time in there where you concentrated on your music, and you had some hard goes there in living, did you not? Your living situation. There was a story in there you tell about living in some place where there's a lot of snow and everything. And you went through the winter, and I mean, it's created character in you, has it not? Some of these hardships.
Yes, it has. And that's what hardships should always do to somebody.
Right.
Whatever doesn't kill you, that old saying, makes you stronger. And all these things certainly made me stronger. But after the house was locked up, Lisa and I we were both working, and so we pulled our resources together and got a little house near Washington, D.C., in a pretty decent little neighborhood. And after that, I took my band, my rock and roll band, and we went to live in northern Wisconsin, which is where the hardships, the weather really started happening. This was a farmhouse out in the middle of huge cornfields, and it had one heating source, and in the wintertime the snow would, and the wind would be just so cold and freezing. All our plants frozen, cracked on the walls, the plumbing cracked and burst because of the cold, and we basically froze to death. But I worked a 12-hour job at a potato factory during that time, and 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, for minimum wage, and we just barely made it through. And within a year after that, I took everybody out to California to see if we could make it as a band.
What were your experiences like in California? Did you concentrate on music or what?
Yes, I did. I concentrated on music, and we had a management company, and we played pretty regular, enough to support us. And we'd been together already a couple of years, and we stayed together for about 10 years, and then we just realized that it wasn't going to happen for us, and we went our separate ways as a band. But we produced some great songs. I wrote some great music, and I continued writing and involving myself in music. To today. So music's been a big part of my life, helping me through some of the darker times, and it's been good.
Yeah, you've raised a couple of children, right?
Mm-hmm. I have a son named Travis.
Okay.
Who's 17, and a daughter, Rachel, who's 26.
Okay.
And they live in California.
Oh, okay. So that worked out okay. In your trials and tribulations, let's get back to the Watergate and so forth. Give us a little chronology leading up to this flight that your mother boarded and so forth. Was she apprehensive about that flight, or what? Was there something that was in the back of her mind, maybe not to go, or what?
She was very apprehensive about this flight. As a matter of fact, she was so apprehensive that for the first time ever, she stopped at the airport long enough to take out a $250,000 insurance policy. I feel that she felt that this could be a flight that she was not going to recover from. In other words, I because of my close contact with my mother at the time, she would come back from these midnight rendezvous that she was doing to pick up cash in various places. And she was scared. She told me people were following her, and she felt her life was in danger. But she was in a position, she was backed into a corner, and she didn't really have a choice. It was either her or that was it. My father couldn't do it, and so she just kept on picking
up
the cash.
Your father's situation, where was your dad at this time that she was collecting this money up? Where was he in prison at the time?
He wasn't officially in prison, but he was in jail, and so they moved him around to 14 different jails.
14
during
ones.
This time.
My gosh!
Yeah, I know. It's something that is done to a prisoner when they want to break his spirit.
Right.
They wanted my dad to talk, and so they kept moving him around to D.C. prison or. To other different locations where he could never really settle down and get settled.
Right. So he was incarcerated. So your mother was on the outside working to try to gain some leverage with the White House. Is that a fair assumption?
A week before the crash, they had my father sent a letter to the White House to Chuck Colson saying. Quote, the Watergate bugging is only one of a number of highly illegal conspiracies engaged in by one or more of the defendants. Okay. Well, the time up to the crash was very fraught with danger for my mother. She was very concerned for her safety and for the children's safety, and for her husband's release, because and also the money coming from the White House, because the it wasn't just our family, it was the McCord and the Liddy family as well that needed the money, and then the four Cubans and their families that needed the money. So we're talking about a lot of cash demands in order to you know, to keep life going for the people that that worked for Nixon in his little spy organization. But after the crash, the very next day, for no apparent reason, Nixon appointed one of his most loyal and top henchmen, a man by the name of Eagle Bud Krogh, K-R-O-G-H, to the position of Undersecretary of Transportation. Now, that Undersecretary of Transportation oversees the National Transportation and Safety Board, the NTSB, which is the sole investigating unit for airline crashes. So that seemed very much out of character. So now Nixon has his top guy overseeing the investigation into my mother's plane crash. That just seemed, okay, that's a coincidence. I can buy that. I can buy that. But then I found out that the FBI, who has no jurisdiction in domestic airline crashes, is crawling all over the scene of the crash within 20 to 40 minutes. They had 50 agents on the ground within less than 40 minutes and left. Yeah, at the crash site within 40 minutes.
Oh, my gosh, that was all planned out then.
So, so they had to be waiting somewhere. The nearest FBI office is 45 minutes away. So, I mean, and it's interesting because the head of the National Transportation and Safety Board, a gentleman by the name of John Reed, he wrote a letter to FBI Director William Ruckelshaus asking for clarity. He said, we understand that the FBI took a number of procedures that were very uncommon, and as the investigation is going to come under public scrutiny, we want to know why there was 50 agents on board, why one of their agents took the recordings from the tower at Midway, and why were you interviewing witnesses on the ground when that's the job of the NTSB. Well, Ruckelshaus wrote back, and he said, in fact, that the FBI has primary investigation jurisdiction in connection with the destruction of aircraft. And he stated that pertaining, among other things, to aircraft piracy, interference with flight crew members, and certain specified crimes aboard aircraft in flight, including assault, murder, manslaughter, and attempts to commit murder or manslaughter. So here we have the head of the FBI writing to the head of the NTSB saying that their jurisdiction was the fact that there was some evidence of murder or manslaughter or attempted murder and manslaughter on that flight. And because there were so many agents that came so quickly to that crash site, they had to have known that something was going to happen to that plane. Maybe they didn't know exactly what it was, but they knew that something was going to happen. There's many other peculiarities. The tail flight recorder stopped working 14 minutes prior to the crash. And later, 2 months later, in March of 73, Nixon appoints another of his top guys, Alexander Butterfield, a Nixon loyalist and White House official, to become administrator of the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration. So now we have Butterfield and Krogh in positions to control and guide the investigation on that particular flight. Never in the history of the FAA or the White House or NTSB ever has these kind of things been done, where the president is appointing people that are then connected to the investigation unit. So there was many other instances of faulty and confusing information being relayed from the Midway Tower and the tower at O'Hare Airport in Chicago to that plane. One of the most outrageous examples is that Midway was directing the United Flight 553 to land on a certain runway, they had also put a small two-prop plane directly in front of the path of the larger United Airlines flight. And it was an aerial commander with the tail numbers N309BS, and it came directly in front of 553 as it was coming in for a landing. the blue markers that guide the plane in on the airport runway were shut off and then turned back on after the plane crashed. It's just such gross negligence that, it made me realize. And then, of course, years later, when my father was giving me his deathbed confession, one of the things he confessed to me was that he always felt strongly that she was murdered and that she didn't die due to pilot error, that plane was brought down specifically because she was on that plane with Michelle Clark, who was a CBS reporter, the first black woman anchor for CBS, and they had agreed to blow the lid off the White House upon their arrival in Chicago. And so I think it was a matter of necessity that that plane be given false instructions, landing instructions, and allowed to crash into a neighborhood.
Right.
Because of that reason.
Was now Sherman's? Oh. Go ahead, Charlie. What do you got?
Well, I was gonna say, yeah. Is this the part where the White House knew that she was on this trip, right, or on this flight? There was the White House tapes revealed that Nixon and his henchmen knew this. I mean, according to your book, is that right? Am I at the right spot?
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
Oh my.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, she felt that she was being followed from these cash pickups in the wee hours, and she was there was people tailing her all over the place. So as she drove to the airport, they knew that she was getting on that flight, I don't know how much in advance they knew, but it's pretty obvious that the White House was all over that, and the FBI was all over that plane crash.
Is it accurate to say, St. John, that there was cyanide found in the flight crew's blood samples after the crash? Is that correct on the autopsies?
Yeah, apparently there was a large percentage of cyanide, especially in Captain Wendell Whitehouse, in his body. And the post-crash fire, at that time, they had one of the ingredients in the seat covers would give off a small amount of cyanide smoke, but this was four times the amount than could have ever been ingested due to the fire. And so, as a matter of fact, in the last 5 minutes of the flight was in control of the second officer. But Wendell Whitehouse was one of the most decorated United Airlines pilots ever. I mean, he had worked for United Airlines for decades, flown thousands and thousands and thousands of hours, and he flew that 737 like that without any problems at all. This was their most seasoned pilot, and to blame it on him is a miscarriage. I feel for his family the humiliation they must have felt when everybody agreed that it was his fault.
which
there's no evidence for.
Right. You have a list of the passengers on that flight. Is that correct? In your book at the end, I see. And I think
that's
out of well respect for those families that lost their loved ones on that flight. I think this was quite a tribute to those families, St. John. Very good taste, in my opinion.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I felt it was important because these people lives are devastated. But, when the CIA takes an operation like this, people go, well, it's just ridiculous that if they're going to kill one person, they're going to take a whole plane out and two houses or three houses that were smashed on the ground. It's not ridiculous. It's the classic CIA maneuver. If they were to kill Dorothy Hunt by herself standing in a corner or in a parking garage, when she's picking up money or whatever, kill her or run her over or shoot her or whatever to keep my father quiet. What's the investigation going to center on? Dorothy Hunt. You take a whole plane out. What's the investigation going to center on? The plane.
Right.
So it's a classic CIA operational mode if you want to get rid of one or two people, you take a much larger amount of people out at the same time, and that masks and diffuses the investigation.
Exactly. Now, your dad loved y'all so much, and your mother especially had a great love for y'all, where your dad was fearful they were going to kill the whole family if he continued to expose Watergate. Is that what he finally reached a conclusion?
Yes, and this was during the mid 2000s when he was really coming clean. Very dramatic one-on-one meetings we had at his bedside, where he just he was so emotional. I thought he was going to just fall apart, and he would grip my hand and he would say something like as his tears were welling up in his eyes and his voice was trembling, he was just so afraid that the harm would come to us children next after they killed his wife, our mother, he was in prison and couldn't protect us. And so he remained silent about all that. But then, of course, before he died, he gave me, the information about his activities revolving around the JFK assassination and things like that to be brought into the public realm after he passed away, which I did. I did my best to do that.
Right. We're going to be up there later on this month on the JFKconference.com. That's the website. And you'll be speaking about what, JFK and this book or just your overall knowledge or what? What are you going to be covering up there, St. John?
Well, what I'm going to be covering is Operation 40. Okay. And it's the thread that it weaves from the Bay of Pigs through the JFK assassination and into Watergate.
Okay.
And how the same people are linked to my father, of course.
Refresh us about Operation 40. Tell our listening audience, what was Operation 40 basically? What was the description of that?
Operation 40 was a group that was undertaken and put together by my father and a couple other CIA chiefs, Tracy Barnes and Richard Bissell, in the early 1960 to assassinate Fidel Castro and his brother Raul, based on recommendations that my father gave in his report after coming back from Cuba in 1959. And so they trained and these gunmen, assassins, in all manner of assassination type of things. And that group was green-lighted by Vice President Richard Nixon.
Right.
And so Nixon feared that some of the same members of Operation 40 that were pointed to Castro to murder Castro and other foreign leaders of other countries, then turned their guns on President Kennedy at some point. And that's what Nixon was worried about, being associated with that.
Your dad and your mom were held in high esteem by the Cuban nationalists. Is that correct?
That is correct. My father was held very highly in the minds of the exiled Cuban community in Florida, because he did the best that he could to liberate Cuba from Castro, and everybody knew that it was out of his hands when the air support was denied for the exiled Cubans that had landed on the beaches at Bay of Pigs.
Right. Earlier, you stated that the FBI just had too many people on the ground at the Midway crash. What was your mother carrying with her, and did she not buy an extra ticket because of some baggage she was carrying, or what? What was she carrying with her?
She carried a briefcase. She had at least $10,000 in cash. Some say more. I would suggest that she had more than that, but $10,000 was going to pay this gentleman in Chicago named Michael Stevens. He was the owner of Stevens Research Labs, which built some of the wiretapping devices for the Watergate burglaries and some of the other burglaries that the plumbers worked. And as a matter of fact, he called the FBI 2 days after the crash, saying that he had been receiving death-threatening calls from persons unknown, saying that he better keep his mouth shut because Dorothy Hunt was killed, murdered, and that's what would be happening to him. And he filed an official report with the FBI in Chicago stating that he had been receiving these death threat calls for his silence. But he insisted that 10,000 of the dollars were going to pay him off for his continued silence. It was just a really bad time, you know. This whole Watergate thing, just, you know, the zeal and the you know, the craziness around this absolute power that the White House was emanating was just got so far out of hand that they were you know, having my father do crazy things like break into Arthur Bremer's apartment in Milwaukee after he shot Wallace and plant pro-McGovern literature in the apartment so that the press would find out and say, oh, Arthur Bremer is a McGovernite, you know, and that would make people, what, not want to vote for McGovern. I mean, that's just silly to me. It seems like, you know, the quality of the intel you get, or the results you get from taking a chance at breaking into a highly sealed off apartment, it just doesn't add up. But they have them doing all kinds of crazy things, you know. They had them going down to Miami and bashing heads, you know, the Cubans, as drunken Democrats, you know, getting into fights over who was going to be nominated for the Democratic Party to run against whoever's running against Nixon in the next election. Just outrageous stuff. The houseboat with the hookers and all that stuff. Just crazy, crazy stuff.
It's called dirty tricks in the political jargon, right?
Yeah. I would say they were pretty dirty and pretty tricky.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you compare it to you know, the things that other administrations have been involved in since then, really, really not nearly as bad. I mean, you can't color degrees of illegalities. It's either illegal or it's not. It's either immoral or it's not. But, I mean, look at what the other administrations since then have been involved in. Iran-Contra, you know, drugs for money, Nina Airport in Arkansas and all that stuff. The Clintons and the Bushes, far more worse things.
Is this what you've become aware of, St. John? Is this the corruption level through the top to the bottom? Everybody's got their hands out for money. It's like worship of mammon and wealth is sort of come about. Is that sort of what you're seeing or what?
Yeah, that's basically what I've come to the conclusion that there's just, the CIA in the early, late 50s thought that they could, bring Kennedy under their knuckle. And they couldn't. And Kennedy was planning on changing the hierarchy of the CIA and bringing it into a doable, controllable organization. And the CIA was not going to have anything to do with that. They policy always emanated from the White House to the other agencies, CIA or State Department or Justice Department. But now in the early 60s, the CIA was in fact trying to turn that around to where they were making policy and telling the White House what to do. And that's, of course, they succeeded in with the assassination of Kennedy. They totally succeeded in that, in their purpose of doing that, because ever since then, the CIA has, in fact, dictated policy that the White House then has to figure out how we're going to carry that out, how we're going to tell the public that we're involved in this secret war or that secret war. It's the CIA running things with these state corporate, bosses.
Right. Your dad, when he went to work for the plumbers in the White House, was he still reporting to the CIA on his activities in the White House?
He was. His whole retirement in 1970 was absolutely false. He had done this once before in 1965, where he retired from the agency and we moved to Madrid, Spain. Well, I found out later that his activities in Spain related to continuing attempts to assassinate Castro, and then of course we moved back to the States, and he rejoined the CIA. In 1970, he supposedly retired from the CIA, but he didn't really. He went deep cover and into the White House and reported directly to the director of CIA, Richard Helms. Most people think that the White House with Charles Colson courted my father into joining them, but actually my father kind of wheedled his way into Colson's realm, and then, of course, Colson took the bait and hired my father. My father was acting basically a double agent at that point, and reporting directly to Helms on Nixon's doings in terms of Nixon's intelligence crimes and things like that.
your mom's opinion when she was in Bern, Switzerland, about her relationship or how she viewed Alan Dulles. Was he a very distant figure, is the way she described him at the time? She was doing administrative work, I assume, in Bern there for the OSS, right?
Yeah, I think she described him as a stern man with a kind face.
Is that right? Okay. Man,
yeah.
What do you think, Sean?
Yeah, that's what she said, I think, or that's what how you put it, right?
Right, right.
And
yeah, Charlotte's got a Navy background. Know, oh, go ahead, St. John.
So that the quote on the front of the book, "An Amoral and Dangerous Woman," that comes out of a CIA report that they did on my mother. Yeah, that's why I chose that quote, because the CIA was calling her an amoral and
dangerous
woman.
Yeah, tell us about that.
And what did it mean? Gentlemen, what do you figure it meant during that time period to be labeled an amoral and dangerous woman?
Yeah,
I mean, that tickled me.
Tell us the story about that, St. John.
Yeah. In researching the book, I came across this entry in a CIA file declassified under the Freedom of Information Act. And it said that Dorothy Wetzel worked in the State Department in Bern, yada, yada. And then she worked for the Treasury Department in Shanghai, China. And she was investigated for agency employment, and they talked about her former husband, who was a drunkard, and her work in the Economic Cooperation Administration in Paris. But they also said that she was a former mistress and was openly flouted as such for several months by my father. She was then described as, quote, "an amoral and dangerous individual who underhandedly attacked those persons who incurred her enmity." Enmity, it's the same word.
Yeah, enmity, yeah.
E-N-N-I-T-Y, enmity, yeah. Amoral is someone, having or showing no concern about whether behavior is morally right or wrong. That's what amoral means. And, of course, I know that's absolutely not true. But the fact that she made that impression to people who felt that they had to write a memo, an internal CIA memo about her, is kind of amusing. But at the same time, it's it's not the only CIA memo I came across. There was also a memo in the book in 1950 that chastised my father, that kind of brought him to somebody's office, saying that his wife was kind of leftist leaning, that she was an individual who carries the torch for minority groups and has always been too ready to take up the battle when any derogatory remarks are made concerning members of these minority groups. And it advised Mr. Hunt to keep his wife in check and make sure that she doesn't act in such a liberal fashion. I mean, they were all over behavior and stuff, and my father, according to this other memo, said that his reaction was that he respected them for that very concern, and that he had discussed it with his wife, and she was no longer going to show her feelings in support of minority groups so openly. So basically, they just wanted her to shut up and play the game. So she was kind of a troublemaker, I guess, in ways. She was very independent and an individual, strong role model for all women, really, when I think about it. This is a woman way ahead of her time. We're looking at the late 1940s, early 1950s, where, there wasn't that many women in intelligence, positions within the CIA. I mean, at the best, a lot of these women that were honey traps. And, she did some of that, too, in Bern. But then she continued on with her hunting Nazi loot and gold and stuff. But yeah, that's where that quote came from, the amoral and dangerous woman from the CIA itself.
Yeah.
Boy.
It's a fantastic write-up and a wonderful story. There's a bumper sticker or a saying or a refrigerator magnet that says, "Well-behaved women rarely make history." And your mother definitely made history.
Well, your mother,
I would think it would be a compliment, in all honesty, in that environment that you had to go through.
I think it is a compliment for your mom. And your mom really cared about y'all too, St. John, and took care of y'all and loved y'all.
Yeah.
You know that?
Yes, she did.
That's what women really, the core of the being of women is to love, life giving and nurturing. And she did that for y'all, didn't she?
Yes, she did. Absolutely, 100%. And I just, it's just so sad to me because, you know, she was going to leave, you know, she was going to separate from my father. And, you know, it just didn't happen because he was so needy. Oh, I need you to do this for me. Oh, I need you to help me. Here's the big CIA tough guy, you know, who's been unfaithful to his wife for years. And she's finally had enough of it, and she's gone to Europe to think things out, and she's come back with a fresh, strong, independent decision. She's going to leave and divorce, and she's going to continue her life with her children away from him. If he wants to work for the White House and get involved in all these crimes, and that's up to him, but she was not going to support it anymore. And then, you know, Mr. Needy, Mr. Tough Guy, you know. Obviously, I have a lot of, you know, resentment for my dad on this one point, you know. But but then it just goes to show, you know, my mother as being so, you know, ultimately, you know, such a giving person that she decided that this one last time to stay. But she must have known that this was not a win-win situation.
Well, your dad, in the end, he could have gone the novelist route to Hollywood, to movies, but he did pick this intelligence path, did he not?
Yes, that's right.
And that sort of set the pace or set the you know, tragic outcome in the future, did it not?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you're right about that.
Well, we certainly enjoyed having you with us this evening. Charlotte, any closing comments, Charlotte?
I just want to thank you for a wonderful book and for letting me know about your mother and her life. And it's a great read. There's some surprising things in there. And she seems to have been a fascinating woman. And you're blessed to have had her as a mother, it sounds like.
Right.
Yes,
you did her
absolutely.
A great tribute.
Well, we're praying for Dorothy.
Thank you so much.
Okay, prayers for Dorothy. Thank you. Thank you, St. John.
All right. Thank you guys for having me,
okay.
George and Charlotte, very much. You guys are great interviewers. I got to talk a lot about personal things, which is really different than a normal interview.
Right. Well, thank you very much, St. John Hunt. We appreciate all the effort you made. Okay?
All right, sir.
Thank you.
All right. See you in Dallas.
Bye.
Okay. See you in Dallas. Bye-bye. Charlotte?
Bye-bye.
Good night.
Good night.